Just a few days ago in Traer, Iowa, near Traer, Iowa, there was a dedication, a ceremony to celebrate the fourth U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Jim Wilson. And we know him as Tama Jim Wilson, of course, from Tama County. But he was the fourth Secretary of Agriculture serving from 1897 to 1913, 16 years. He was not only the longest serving Secretary of Agriculture in the U.S., he was the longest serving cabinet member in the U.S., and that record still stands. Well, Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack is from Iowa. He is the fifth Iowan to be a U.S. Secretary. He's the 30th in total. Secretary Vilsack, records are to be broken. 12 more years. Well, again, 1897 to 1913 is a very long time, and if you think about it, Jim Wilson had, for him, the implementation of the Homestead Act. And there was still frontier in America during that time period. And he was giving away farms, 160-acre farms, if you would merely reside on that farm for 5 years and homestead it. Not a bad job, actually. He did not have a farm bill to deal with. He did not have sequestration to deal with. You know, if you think about it, you're dealing with issues today, Secretary Vilsack, of trade and diminishing levels of rural advocacy and influence, biotechnology, food safety, and the lack of that farm bill. You know, I think there ought to be some kind of an index. He should get at least 2 years of credit for every year that he serves to help him along in this goal. But regardless, we are very pleased to have you serve as U.S. Secretary, another Iowan. We're proud of the work you're doing. You're doing a great job, and I'd offer you the podium.
You know, Tama Jim started his 16-year career as Ag Secretary at age 62. So just get your arms around that. And I told Craig earlier today that I've got a new definition of optimism. I know I'm speaking to a group of optimists here. The faith that you have in what you do and Mother Nature requires you to be an optimist. But a new definition for me, since Christy and I just purchased a home, is a 30-year mortgage at age 62. So I don't know if I'll do the 12 years, but I'm certainly pleased to have this opportunity, and it's a great opportunity. And I appreciate Craig Hill's invitation to speak here. I will tell you that Craig is a very solid leader of Iowa Farm Bureau and one who is well-respected not just in the state of Iowa, but nationally. I can tell you in my conversations with Bob Stallman, who does a good job of representing the American Farm Bureau Federation in Washington, D.C., that Bob and other leaders in Farm Bureau look to Craig for direction and instruction in terms of policy. You're certainly a valued member of that national team. I also want to acknowledge Secretary Northey. I think I'm responsible for that short invocation. I suggested that when President Hill suggested to Secretary Northey that he be provide the invocation, I said, gee, man, you're going to put a politician and a preacher together? He's going to speak for 2 hours. Well, he shortened it. But he, too, is, in all sincerity, Bill Northey is also one who is well-respected, not just in the state of Iowa, but across the country. We had a chance to work closely last year as he was the president and the head of the National Association of Commissioners and Secretaries of Agriculture, a very important position and one that I think allowed him to understand more fully the diversity of American agriculture and the challenges that commissioners and secretaries have at the state level, and did a very, very excellent job of working through a very difficult period when we were impacted and affected by such a large-scale drought, one we hadn't seen for 80 years, and hopefully it will be at least that long when we see another one of that depth. I know that some may still be suffering from drought, but certainly it's not quite as bad as it was this time last year. And I also want to acknowledge my good friend John Whitaker, who is here today in his capacity as the state director of our FSA, obviously very important to farmers and producers in this state. And John is doing a great job heading that effort. You know, I saw the topic for this conference, and I was struck by the fact that you're obviously going to focus on grain, which makes sense for this group, and then you're also going to focus on gridlock. And so I thought maybe what I should do initially is to suggest to you that despite the fact that our Congress may have a difficult time making decisions and getting things done, which I will discuss at the end of this discussion, I think it would be helpful for you to know that we are still working at USDA to try to help producers across the country. Today, for example, we announced decisions that we've made about our 45th CRP general sign-up. We received 28,000 offers throughout the United States. We've signed up and accepted offers of about 1.7 million acres. That's going to mean that we've enrolled around 12 million acres since 2009. And I think it's important when we make these announcements not so much to focus on the number of acres that are being signed up, but the impact and effect of those acres and the fact that we focus this program on highly erodible land, the kind of land that ought not to be farmed aggressively. And because of that, we're beginning to address a serious issue here in this country, and that is of soil erosion, something that I know that every single person here is deeply concerned about. CRP is allowing us to avoid about 300 million tons of soil erosion annually, and that means that we're not putting as much nitrogen and phosphorus into our waterways, which is also an extraordinarily important issue. To be specific about this, this program prevents about 605 million pounds of nitrogen from getting into our water supply and having them to be treated and so forth, and about 121 million pounds of phosphorus. So it's an important program in terms of water quality. 86% of the contracts that were proposed for the state of Iowa were accepted today. It's going to put us at about 47,300 or 400 acres being offered. That would mean we'd have about 1.4 million acres enrolled in the state. So that's one way in which we are trying to continue to do our work at USDA. Another way is to equip you all with strategies for dealing with what is absolutely a fact, which is that the climate is changing. Folks may disagree about what's causing the climate to change, but nobody, especially those who are so close to the land and so dependent on Mother Nature, can dispute the fact that we're seeing significant climate change. And we've actually just released a report earlier this year on the impact and effect of climate change on both agriculture and forestry. And the bottom line is that unless we begin to aggressively promote adaptation and mitigation strategies, we may not be able to do in the long term what we are currently being able to do here in this state or any other state in terms of agricultural production. That's one of the reasons why we embraced a soil survey, the largest soil survey of its kind in the history of humankind. We did 144,000 samples in over 6,200 locations throughout the United States. And the purpose of it was to create a foundation of understanding about the condition of soil throughout the United States. Now we're going to be able to use that information in the development of a tool called Comet Farm, C-O-M-E-T, dot farm. This is going to enable producers to actually input information about their specific farm, their specific farming practices, and be able to calculate the impact and effect on greenhouse gases, the impact and effect on inputs, which in turn is going to allow us at some point in time to be able to establish market opportunities for those who are regulated, a utility or another regulated industry, to be able to help meet their regulatory responsibilities by investing in conservation in farms across the United States and conservation practices across the United States, from no-till to cover cropping to mulching and things of that nature. So it's a new income opportunity that we're trying to create for producers across the country. We also understood that as we dealt with adaptation strategies for climate change, one of the problems was that we were giving you inconsistent information from FSA, from RMA, and from NRCS in terms of cover crops. So we have come up with a single guidance that now governs all three agencies. It is regionalized and localized. That was supposed to come in the middle of your invocation. And the purpose of this is to understand that every region of the country is in fact different. Different weather, different topography, different local conditions, which will enable us to more specifically target the capacity to educate folks on precisely what cover crops would be most effective and when they would be the most effective in terms of the consequences to soil and water quality. This is also consistent with our development of climate change hubs. These are research areas throughout the United States that will be giving you all information, techniques, and technology that will allow you to better adapt and mitigate to a changing climate. This is a long-term view. And part of our challenge, I think, in farming and part of our challenge specifically at the USDA, and maybe even to the extent within state agricultural commissions and departments, is that we think in one-year terms in terms of budgets, we think of five-year terms in terms of a farm bill. We really need to be thinking in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40-year terms in terms of our capacity to continue to ensure that America is the greatest agricultural country in the world. That's why we have begun to focus on a soil health campaign to be able to enable all of you to continue to increase organic matter in your soil, increase its capacity to retain scarce water resources, and continue your productivity. Speaking of water, we have been heavily engaged, as you well know, in the Upper Mississippi River Basin as part of our Healthy Watershed Network. We have coupled that with our National Water Quality Initiative to assist farmers in being able to deal with voluntary conservation, to incent voluntary conservation. We now have invested nearly $300 million since I've become secretary in this effort in just the Upper Mississippi River area. And I've been telling Secretary Northey that it was very difficult for me as a secretary, former governor of Iowa, to go to the state of Minnesota and have to deal with their water certification program, where they've identified four pilot areas, and I had to tell them that they were first in the nation. You know how difficult that is? I had to make sure that they knew that they were now entitled to additional EQIP money. Do you know how difficult that is for me to have to acknowledge that in front of the governor of Minnesota and a senator from Minnesota, secretary? There are opportunities here in the state of Iowa. The recent passage by the state legislature of a water quality initiative, additional resources to the secretary's and the governor's efforts. You now have the capacity to identify potential pilot projects, and we absolutely want to work with the state of Iowa to begin to build momentum for these voluntary efforts. We think it can attract additional resources for conservation to the state of Iowa, and, of course, those resources roll around in the economy, as you well know. We're still dealing with drought, and that's one of the reasons why we invested several million dollars in our Conservation Innovation Grant program focused on providing new and additional ways of dealing with drought. We're coming up with improved irrigation strategies, improved grazing strategies, optimal warm season forage systems that will help livestock producers and producers all across the United States deal with the consequences of continuing drought, which we are unfortunately still dealing with. We just recently concluded in May a conference on antibiotic use. We know that's an issue to a lot of our producers, and we were able through this conference to identify some serious information gaps that will allow us to do a better job of communicating the impacts and effects and the positive impacts and effects of appropriate use of antibiotics in terms of livestock. Now, we know that there are data deficits in terms of an understanding of precisely how much and how often these antibiotics are in fact used by our livestock producers. We're going to try to bridge those gaps, try to provide more accurate information, create better metrics so that we can do a better job of informing everyone about the appropriate use of antibiotic use. Craig mentioned trade. You know, we are aggressively promoting free trade, as you all know, but we are casting a wary eye on discussions as it relates to the EU. I've had a number of conversations recently with members of the EU, ag commissioners, secretaries of state, and others, to suggest to them that if there is to be a free trade agreement with Europe, it must be a comprehensive free trade agreement. It must deal with all of the thorny issues in agriculture, not the least of which are our geographic preferences, not the least of which is the EU's attitude, at least the official attitude, about biotechnology, that there needs to be a better understanding and a better acceptance and a willingness to embrace these new technologies if we are to meet the enormous challenge that we and they and all of us have to meet global food demand as it continues to increase. I've said this in virtually every speech I've given recently. The task is enormous. We've done an amazing job in the United States of being more productive. But the reality is that over the next 40 years, we're going to have to pick up our pace, not just here, but across the globe. We have to increase global food production by roughly 70% in the next 40 years to give you a sense of how difficult that challenge is. Please understand that to do so, we will require as much innovation in agriculture in the next 40 years as we've had in the previous 10,000 years. So that puts a premium on focusing on research and the like. So we will continue to promote free trade. We'll continue to aggressively break down sanitary and phytosanitary barriers as we have. Last year, several hundred were broken down. We're continuing to work with our friends in China to create a more synchronized biotechnology regulatory process. As you may know, China begins its regulatory process only when we finish ours, which adds years and years and years to the process. The reality is we think that at least we ought to be able to begin at the same time. That should encourage more of this technology getting into the field more frequently. We still, despite our challenges, despite the issues, despite all of the SBS issues we confront, we're still looking at a record year in terms of trade. The last 5 years have been the best 5 years in agricultural trade in the history of our country. We're focused on increasing market opportunities, not the least of which is in the bioeconomy. We will aggressively defend the RFS. And I will tell you, no news to all of you, it is under serious review and I would suggest under serious attack by Big Oil. And it will become necessary for us to again remind folks why it's important to have a renewable fuel industry. Traditionally, we've talked about the fact that it's a job creator, and it is, 400,000 jobs connected to this industry. We've talked about how it's helped to stabilize prices for commodities, and it has, which may be the reason why we've seen record farm income recently. We talk about the fact it provides choice for consumers at the pump, and that they will actually end up paying far less for their oil, for their gasoline, than they might otherwise pay, in some cases anywhere from 25 cents to a dollar a gallon less. And we've talked about how it's reduced this country's reliance on foreign oil. What we haven't talked about is the national security imperative. Just consider this. If oil gets to $147 a barrel, which it has been in the past, and it will likely at some point in time in the future get to, 50% of the entire global wealth will be in the hands of OPEC nations. That puts them in a remarkable position to control a lot about the future direction of their countries and of the globe. And those folks don't necessarily agree with our views on democracy. So it is important and necessary for us to understand what's at stake here. It's also important for us to understand that all of this discussion about how much oil there is in the world assumes that we can get to it. The reality is that they're having difficulties in South America getting to the oil because when they drill deep down to get the oil, the steel of the drilling mechanisms actually melts. Someone's going to have to figure out how to make steel stronger before they're going to be able to access all of that oil. That may take some time. The oil in the South China Sea is wrapped up in geopolitical discussions, which are extraordinarily complicated and not likely to get worked out in the near term. That which is located in Africa must assume that there are mechanisms, governmental mechanisms and regulations in place that makes it easy for companies to be willing and confident and secure in the investments that they would have to make to be able to access that oil. Last time I checked, there's not as much stability in many of those countries as needed. So it is important for us to have this industry. But we must extend it far beyond just fuel. We must see this for the extraordinary opportunity to redefine the American economy, to restructure and to reintroduce manufacturing back in this country and in rural areas, because it's not just fuel that we can make. It's not just renewable energy opportunities that we can develop. There are biochemicals and bioplastics and biofabrics and biofibers that can be created from virtually everything we grow and waste product from virtually everything we grow. There's enormous market opportunity for producers and landowners, and there's a chance to reintroduce rural manufacturing to create the kinds of jobs that will allow us to continue to make the case to our young people that there's opportunity, not just in farming, but also in living and working and raising their families in these small towns. It's extraordinarily important for this country to understand the opportunity that we now have in front of us. It's one of the reasons why the President's been focused, and I've been focused, on extending our BioPreferred program. That BioPreferred program basically says to industry, we as a federal government, we purchase a lot of stuff, and what we want to purchase is stuff that's bio-based. We want to be able to continue to purchase the hydraulic oil that operates the elevator at the Statue of Liberty, which is bio-based. We want to continue to have our Defense Department recognize the value of bio-based products as they make purchases for the Army and for the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines. There's a tremendous untapped opportunity here. It's why I've been going to places like Ohio State and focusing on how they use hog manure to produce asphalt, and why I've gone to Wisconsin to see new opportunities in terms of bioplastics. There's a company that's going to make plastic bottles for Coca-Cola. $10 billion a year is their demand, their need. That's just one company. It's an enormous opportunity to use corn cobs and other natural material to produce this bioplastic so that those bottles will be 100% plant-based. A tremendous opportunity. We are focused on this. We have just recently announced additional categories in our BioPreferred program to make it a little bit easier for markets to develop, and we're going to continue to aggressively promote this. We are indeed engaged in agricultural research, and we are on the campus of one of the great research universities. As it relates to agriculture, we need to continue to invest in agricultural research. For far too long, we flatlined that opportunity. And there is very ample proof that if you invest in research, you can extend production in this country. If you don't invest in research, you will see production flatline. And we will lose our status as the number one agricultural country in the world. That's why we are working on things like gene flow of open pollinated crops, why we're looking at ways in which we can produce alfalfa that doesn't necessarily damage the opportunities that organic producers need to have their crops raised in a particular way. It's why we're going to continue to provide open data opportunities where we've taken all of the information that we've accumulated at USDA over the years, and we're now making it available for people to consider and look at opportunities. Because of this open data initiative, I was at a company earlier today here in Ames that wants to take information from tractors, from combines, all the computer systems that you all have, be able to aggregate that information and create ways in which you can better understand your operation and maybe even reduce the input costs of your operation with additional information, which will allow you to compare your particular operation to the county or to the region in terms of performance. They're just enormous opportunities. Now, none of this can happen unless we have three things. First, we have to have a budget. It helps to have a budget to be able to continue to fund this. Craig mentioned sequester. We are dealing, and I want you all to know this, we understand our responsibility to be efficient and effective and to look for ways in which we can save money. So we have aggressively promoted our administrative services process, which we launched at the Farm Bureau meeting in Hawaii 2 years ago. Since that speech that I gave in Hawaii 2 years ago, we've identified nearly $900 million annually in savings. We've reduced vehicles, cell phone contracts, landlines, offices, labs. We've gone through an extensive process, and we're continuing to go through that process because you demand of us greater efficiency and greater performance. But it helps to have a budget, to be able to know with some certainty what our resources are and to have the flexibility to be able to move those resources if you, in fact, are confronted with an emergency circumstance or situation. You can't do that if you're under sequester. You can't do that if you have a continuing resolution that basically binds you to a certain amount that you got in the preceding year. Our operating budget at USDA is $1 billion less than it was when I came into this office. And I don't know whether, I know that Tama Jim didn't have that circumstance. He increased significantly the budget of USDA when he was secretary. And virtually every other secretary since then has done that. We are probably the first in a long time that has actually reduced our operating without, I believe, sacrificing the quality of the service we're providing. The second thing we need is a 5-year farm bill. I know that you wanted me to get to this, but it is important. It seems like I was here just like last year at this time talking about this. Two points I want to make about this. Three points. One, this notion of splitting the food programs from the farm programs, please do not believe that that's in the long-term best interest of producers, because it is not. Here's why it's not. 33,000 farming operations in this country produce 50% of everything we produce. 200,000 to 300,000 produce about 85%. That's less than 1/10 of 1%. The 33,000 is 1/10 of 1/10 of 1%. Where are the other 99%? They're not on the farms. They're not producing the vast majority of what you all produce. They don't understand what you do. They have a hard time even appreciating what you do. And so when they send members to Congress and to the Senate, they may send folks who do not have an appreciation for what you do. And those folks may find it hard to understand the importance of having a safety net, of why crop insurance is not just important for producers, but it's also important for the communities where producers live. Because when you have that money from crop insurance, the $17 to $18 billion that was paid out last year during the worst drought in 80 years, you actually spend that money in your local community. That helps to support the local grocery store and the local bank and the local hardware store and the local supply folks. It helps to stimulate the economy. They may not understand that. So you've got to give them a reason why it's important for them to think that a farm bill is more than a farm bill. They have to understand it is a food bill. It is a jobs bill. That will impact and affect their constituents. If you separate those two things, you lose that leverage. You lose that capacity to convince, to persuade, to advocate. Why would you do that? You shouldn't do it. Split's not in your long-term best interests. Secondly, if we can't get this job done, if Congress can't get it done on September 30th, please do not succumb to the pressure of extending existing programs. Because if you do, number one, you're going to reward failure. When was the last time in your homes, with your family, or even in your operations, that you rewarded failure? I suspect never. Why would you reward failure in your Congress? Number one. Number two, an extension does nothing for those livestock producers and dairy producers who need disaster assistance through a very difficult drought circumstance. It still plagues people today in very, very many areas of the country. It doesn't reform the system. Honestly, folks, it's hard to explain direct payments to folks who are not understanding and fully appreciating of what is involved in agriculture. You can explain crop insurance because people understand insurance. They don't understand checks being sent when crop prices are at record highs. It's hard to explain this. So there's no reform opportunity with extension. There's no assistance and help for specialty crop producers or organic producers, a fast-growing aspect of American agriculture. Why would we want to discourage that? It's a way in which smaller-sized operations can begin. It's a way in which we can get young people into the system. It doesn't create any opportunities for beginning farmers and veterans. The bill passed by the Senate includes incentives, includes some breaks on crop insurance, makes it a little bit easier for folks to get in this business. You don't get that with an extension. You don't get the research foundation that would help us leverage and extend significantly the money that's going to places like Iowa State. You don't get any of that with an extension. And you don't get an energy title that helps to continue to support the renewable energy industry, nor do you get the opportunity to extend that to the bioeconomy and creating additional market opportunities for agricultural waste, additional opportunities for non-productive land, and additional jobs in rural America. You don't get any of that with an extension. I mean, the reality is, if you look back over the course of the last several years, the only time folks work in Congress is when there's a crisis. Think about it. Why did we get the extension last year? It's because folks understood that without an extension, milk prices were going to go up. And they promised us, they pledged to us, they'd get it done after the election. They didn't get it done after the election. And they haven't gotten it done the first 6 months of this year. when I said we weren't going to have inspectors with sequester, that we were going to have to pull them out of our meat inspection responsibilities, which was going to shut down our processing facilities, when they finally became convinced that that was actually true, what did they do? They created the resources to allow us to have inspectors. Even when folks stood in long lines at airports because the air traffic controllers weren't getting all the money and assistance that they needed to keep people on board, what did Congress do when folks started to complain? They found the money somehow, some way, to fund the FAA. You can't reward failure. The last thing I would say is that people need to understand that this is far more than just a farm bill. As important as that is to everybody in this room, but it is a jobs bill. It is a research bill. It is an innovation bill. It is a conservation bill. It's an energy bill. It's an entrepreneurial bill. It's all of that and much more. And we've got to do a better job of explaining to people throughout the United States that this farm bill is not just about the 33,000 operations that produce 50% of what we produce, or the 200,000 to 300,000 that produce 85%, or the 2.3 million that are qualified as farmers under our definition. It's about every single American. And let me finish with this. I'm in the process of reading a trilogy about World War II. So about it starts with the Battle of North Africa, and then it goes into the Battle of Italy, and I suspect it's going to end with the European theater. What strikes me about that trilogy is how many mistakes the generals made and how many mistakes the regular GIs overcame. And that's why they were called the greatest generation, because of the enormous sacrifice they made. I realize that when I speak to this group, I'm speaking to the greatest generation of farmers, not just in the history of this country, but in the history of humankind. You deserve better than this. You deserve a Congress that understands what you're doing. A Congress that understands that we are a strong, secure nation because we can feed ourselves. Do not take that for granted, because virtually no other nation on earth can say that. We're a strong, secure nation because we're diversifying our energy needs by the contribution that's being made by American producers and landowners in rural America with windmills and biofuels. We're the greatest generation, and you are the greatest generation of American producers, because you provide all the rest of us with the ability to walk out of a grocery store with more money in our pocket to allow us to spend it on a variety of other things that stimulate this economy and makes it strong. And then on top of all of that, you continually support our military by sending your sons and daughters off to service in disproportionate numbers. You all need to think of yourselves, and we need to recognize you as that greatest generation. And believe me, when there's a discussion about American veterans and the greatest generation, nobody hesitates to ask, what's the cost? We're putting more resources into our military, more resources into our veterans, as we should, because of the sacrifices they made, the contributions they made to me and to my family. I see all of you in that same way. So I'm dedicated to working as long and as hard as I can, as long as I have this great privilege, to be the Secretary of Agriculture, to make sure that our friends in Washington, our friends all across the United States and the world, understand who you are and what you do. And if they understand that fully and completely, they'll get a farm bill passed. They'll provide a budget, and we'll continue to be the greatest producers on earth. Thank you.